The baby boomer generation has really left a mark on American society. And I think as historians, a couple of hundred years from now, if there is still an earth by then or looking back at our time, they're going to see that because we're already seeing that to an extent. There's been changes in the schools. There's been changes in health care. But one mark where there has been a very distinctive change has been in the area of religion. In the 1980s, late 1980s, and then throughout the 1990s, it became quite trendy by the baby boomer generation to begin looking for something different religiously. And so what began to happen is people were looking and saying we need to have our worship that's going to be more meaningful and more enjoyable for everyone. And so we need to contemporize our worship. And this led way then to signs or things like this that you might see, ads like this, where many churches would begin saying, we have new service times. In fact, I remember over in Limestone County, there was a sign that for several months was covered, and it simply said, coming soon, to get everybody's attention. And then when the sign was finally unveiled, it was a church saying, we are now offering traditional worship. And then this kind of new word below it, contemporary worship. So come at 9 o'clock if you prefer traditional, come at 11 o'clock if you prefer contemporary. And this set off what has come to be called the worship wars. And the worship wars kind of went throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. And you had this great debate over whether it should be traditional or whether it should be contemporary. Well, as we begin looking at that now, it appears we're kind of on the downhill side of it. That maybe what people were viewing that was going to be so successful didn't quite work as they wanted. And so we're seeing less and less of those contemporary signs. But yet one thing I know is that many times when something's dying away, you've still got one group who will say, I think we can revive it. I think we can make this work. And many times that's where some of our brethren come in, who began to take these things that have failed in the Protestant world and begin trying to put them into effect in congregations that have typically followed a New Testament pattern. So my question for us this morning is, should we give contemporary worship a second look? The things that were brought about that were going to make all of these great changes, could they really work? Well, let's explore that this morning. And so here's our question. Should we give it a second look? And my answer to that is yes, we should. Because when you look at the definition of contemporary, this is what it says. Belonging to or occurring in the present. With that definition, I'm all about contemporary worship. Why? Because with that definition, we understand that worship not only should be, it must be contemporary. What do we find? We find that we never outgrow God. There are those of our society who say that religion is a crutch on which weak people lean, that we have, through science and technology, grown out of the superstitious view of God. No. God is always present. We never outgrow Him. The psalmist, way back when, realized that very thing. He said, Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever You had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, You are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years in Your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. Has there ever been a person from Adam on down who has ever outgrown God? Who has never been a contemporary, so to speak, with God? And the answer to that is absolutely not. We never outgrow it. I think as well as we consider that, there must always be a desire for worship. This must never be past tense. And here's where a lot of people get in trouble because they begin viewing worship as traditional. What people did way back when, and we're in a new era and a new society, and so a lot of people view worship as something that their parents or their grandparents were associated with. That's false. The desire for worship must be active and present in every person, no matter what time one lives. Again, I refer us back to the psalmist. Psalm 102, verse 18, "Let this be recorded for a generation to come, so that a people yet to be created may praise the Lord." The psalmist says there are times coming when others will need to worship God, so record things about Him for them. The desire for worship must always be present tense. And thus, whether one is a hymnist writing hymns for worship, whether one is a preacher, whatever role one takes, there's got to be a concentrated effort to show that God is relevant for our society. And that is certainly the case in our worship and our preaching right now, is that we are wanting to show this generation that God is indeed relevant, that He is contemporary. Yes. Belonging to or occurring in the present, yes, we need to be contemporary. However, no, we don't need to give it a second look when we think about the definition that has been used for the past 20 years. You see, there's a little something that's called equivocation. And equivocation is where you begin an argument with one idea, and somewhere in the midst of your argument, you change the definition. Here's a word and you start out with it meaning one way and you get people nodding in agreement with that, and then somewhere you suddenly change the definition to what you want to push out, and all of a sudden you've got people who will follow along with that. Well, if you look in a dictionary for the word contemporary, the number one definition is the one I just gave you. When you get down to definition 3 or 4, it's this: following modern ideas in style and design. And so thus, the baby boomer generation, in their desire to contemporize worship, did not stop with definition number one, but followed it on down to this idea that we are going to make what we're doing fit. And so, it is not the idea of presenting the Lord to modern society. It's the idea of modernizing God for contemporary society. That this God who is so woefully out of date, who is so past generation, we got to take Him and we've got to liven it up a little bit and put new clothes on Him and make Him appealing to the 21st century. That's our danger. And so what do we find? Well, let's think about the characteristics of contemporary society. And I think what we'll see in this is where this idea of changing worship came about. I don't think any of us would disagree that 21st century America in particular, but really throughout the Western world, has had a whole lot less focus on rules. You need go no further than modern advertising for this, do you? What has Outback Steakhouse been saying for several years now? No rules. No rules. Well, that's okay for a steakhouse, but it's a problem when you start thinking about society. When you start looking at how schools have lessened the rules, I think because of an outcry from maybe a generation of parents who weren't too crazy about rules because they weren't instilled in them as children. You think about laws and everything else, we're seeing that in our society. I don't think there'd be much disagreement that our society is very focused on me. It's the idea that we want our mental and our physical comfort to be high priority. We don't want anybody telling us what we can't do. That's the breaking of the rules or the lessening of the rules. And we don't want anybody making us feel uncomfortable. I got rather amused that just this past week, United Airlines got into this big uproar because they told a couple of girls, "We want you dressed a little bit better for this flight. You're flying on us. We're paying for your tickets." And there was this great uproar, and Delta Airlines, of course, seized the moment, and they sent out a tweet that said, "We want our guests to be comfortable all the time." That typifies our society. Comfort is maximum, but it's also mental comfort. We don't want anybody telling us we're wrong. We don't want anybody telling us we need to change. We don't want anybody telling us our lifestyle is problematic. And so we've got this great focus then on personal comfort. And I surely don't think anyone would disagree that we would say 21st century America has a major focus on entertainment. Look at the news broadcast, if you want an illustration of this. Whereas years ago, you might see Walter Cronkite cranking out all these world stories. Now, who are we hearing about? The Kardashians and the late last marriage to break up in Hollywood. And this is supposed to be on real news. Why? Because we're very entertainment focused. We like that kind of thing. And so much of our society has become consumed with providing an enjoyable and a fun environment. Well, I'm not saying we can't have fun. I'm not saying that we don't need to focus sometimes on ourselves in certain ways. But when you begin looking at the extremes to which this has been taken, I think it's showing us the kind of culture in which we're living. But now let me focus you back on that definition. Following modern ideas and style and design, and thus, when you say we're going to contemporize worship, we're going to follow modern ideas, certainly these things become very much a part of it, as we're going to see. So the question then is, way back when, why? Why was it that people decided we needed to make this change? Why was it that there were those who said that worship, by the way it used to be done, was no longer an effective means? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but let me give you the two that I believe are probably at the top of most lists. One is this, that people should not be bored in church. That the problem that we're having in getting people to coming is because really the traditional way of doing things is boring, it's dull, and therefore we've got to do something to liven it up. I'd like to show you a couple of quotes here. The first one is from Max Lucado, who you're probably familiar with. He's done a lot of writing. And it's easy to see through Lucado's writing the journey he has taken into contemporary religion. Several years ago, he was interviewed by a magazine, and this quote is taken from that interview. He said in that Preaching magazine of 2005, "No longer can we afford the luxury of thinking that the people who are sitting in our pews are going to be there every Sunday. We have to arrest their attention. We have to use every device possible to reach them and to teach them, and we need not be so apologetic about entertaining them. I mean, they have been entertained all week long, every time they turn around. I have no apology for putting a good singer in front of them to entertain them if they're not Christians. You got to do something to reach them." Okay, that's it. That's what we were talking about earlier, where you're contemporizing religion with what modern society is like. He makes the statement, they've been entertained all week long. That's society. That's culture. And therefore, he says, if we're going to keep that same level of excitement, I make no apologies about entertaining. That's the idea of trying to make church less boring. Now, another reason that's oftentimes given is this traditional routine of worship is not going to reach the postmodern crowd. We're in a culture that has kind of grown beyond Christianity in many ways, and so if we're going to appeal to this particular group, we've got to reach them in a very different way. Another quote I'd like to show you is from a minister in one of the big denominational churches. He had just been to see, I had to look this up, by the way, I'll show my ignorance here, the Broadway play Godspell. Okay, so this is kind of the context here. So Barry McMurdy said, "Then I went to Godspell. Godspell was based on children in a playground acting out the stories from the Gospel of Matthew. At first I thought, this is stupid. He should have stopped there. Then it started to get to me. I looked around at," listen to his words here, "I looked around at all these pagans," insert postmoderns there, "responding, laughing and even weeping. And I thought, this is our job. When we left, I'm feeling elated. I said to my wife, Gay, why can't we leave church feeling like this?" She looked at me and said, "Why can't we?" And what he goes on to say is how he went back and began to contemporize the worship at this particular church, to make it in this vein of the Broadway play he had just watched. Well, that's the idea that we're looking at. And so it's not this stately atmosphere that we're looking for anymore, but instead something that's going to be exciting and fun and entertaining. That's the direction that we're seeing. Here's what I want us to understand. What we have seen in these two quotes and countless others we could look at from the past 20 years is that this is nothing new. It's not as though in the late 1980s somebody came up with this brainstorm and said, hey, let's contemporize things. We don't want things to be boring anymore. No, God told us about that in the book of Malachi way back when. Listen to what God says when Israel grew bored with religion and worship. He through his prophet said, but you say, what a weariness this is. And you snort at it, says the Lord of hosts. You bring what has been taken by violence or as lame or sick, and this you bring as your offering. Shall I accept that from your hand, says the Lord? What we don't find Malachi saying is, well, we got to change things. We got to ratchet this up, make it more exciting. That's not his message. But yet, what do we find here? We find the idea of boredom. We're tired of the routine. We're tired of the way this is going. We go back a little bit earlier in Israel's history, and I think we find, again, an idea of seeking to contemporize things. And what do we find? That Israel began trading God for contemporary paganism. You know, one of the big things God said to them, when you go into the land of Canaan, you must not become like those folks. You must not take up their ways. You must not take up their idols, because God knew how easy it is for His people to adopt the culture in which they're living. And so what happens? These pagan religions had less rules. You ever read through the book of Exodus? All of these worship rules, head on into Leviticus, all of these rules. I'm going to tell you, that's some tough reading, isn't it? I oftentimes say that's where a lot of daily Bible readings go off track, is when you get there, because here is God saying, this is what I want. This is how you're to do it. This is why you're to do it. But you consider Israel, who looks over to the greener pastures of paganism, and they find here not all of those rules. And not having all of those rules means they can be more focused on themselves. You know, for a long time I would wonder, growing up, well, why do they go off toward these idols? Why is it that they're going toward these things? And you start looking at what they go to, and it becomes very clear. Look from Numbers chapter 25. The people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. That's the worship. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So here you've got the appeal to the flesh. In this case, physically, sexually, the appeal was there. The appeal to fill the stomach. You've got the idea of, if I go there, there's a lot in it for me. I can satisfy my desires with that. And certainly in the midst of all of that, we can certainly see that it was focused on entertainment. Anything goes. I hope you see the point I'm making. That what we have seen for the past few years is absolutely nothing new. People have been making this same journey over and over again because of a dissatisfaction that they have with God's plan. But now let me go to a reason that very much on the surface seems to bear a whole lot of weight. Some will say to us, but won't this change bring the loss to God? If we offer something exciting, is that not going to bring more people to our number? And the answer on the surface to that is, yes, it will. However, let's look at the Bible to see what kind of precedent we have for that. Who is the best one to look to? Well, of course, that's Jesus Christ Himself. And so here's Jesus, and He's teaching, and He performs this great miracle of feeding 5,000 people, over 5,000 people. And he gains this great following and they come back looking for more. They're looking for more food. And Ben read to us this morning kind of the context of all of that, where Jesus says, don't you understand I'm the bread of life? I'm what you need to be hungering. I'm what you need to be craving. And he would not give the people what they desired. You remember what we find a few verses down? John chapter 6, verse 66. After this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. Do we realize Jesus could have doubled, tripled, quadrupled his following if he had just given them what they desired? Jesus was intent on saving mankind, but it was going to be on God's terms, not man's. Salvation, the great gift that was offered, was going to be based on what God desires and nothing else. And thus we find throughout the ministry of Jesus, he never entertained or compromised. I think about the temptations that he underwent. When the devil said, go to the pinnacle of the temple and jump down and angels will come and bear you down to safety. You think Jesus would have gained a few followers from that? If people walking through the temple grounds had looked up and seen this guy standing up there and he leaped and all of a sudden angels came from heaven and snatched him up and set him down, there would have been people who bowed down and followed him at that point. But the question would then become, what's next? What's our next big exciting thing that we can see that's going to satisfy this need for entertainment? Jesus never did that. He never compromised. And we need to make sure that we're not falling into that same trap. A worship service is not the means of salvation. What's the means of salvation? Well, Paul told us that very clearly in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21. For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach. What did he preach? The message of salvation, the message of Jesus Christ. That's what's going to save those who believe. And thus we must be very careful when we begin to try to turn worship to God into an evangelist effort here to bring people in by entertainment and singing and whatever. That's a dangerous thing. I know nothing about the man who designed what I'm about to show you, but I think he kind of hit the nail on the head. He said, this is the worship evolution. And I know the writing's kind of small, but over here on phase one, you've got true worship in purity and transparency, prudence and dignity. Phase two, dependence on God, a growth there, the favor and a grateful heart. And three, the disposition and service. But then note what begins to happen. He says in phase four, there's an independence, personal interest and changing of vision that leads to indisposition, self-service and self-satisfaction, and finally, idolatry, self-worship, and an ungrateful heart. And that's what we must beware. That when we are perhaps for legitimate reasons trying to change things up, we must realize that the law of unintended consequences may very well take us to that last stage where certainly we don't want to be. So what do we do? Well, the moral of all this is we maintain proper worship to God. That it's not a matter of traditional and contemporary and that kind of thing. It's a matter of we're going to please Him. And as we consider that idea, we understand that worship is always vertical. Worship is always looking to God and His glory and His honor. We've leaned very heavily on the Psalms this morning because they give us such a picture of worship. And notice what we find in Psalm 86. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name, for you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. That needs to typify worship. You are great. There's no one like you. We want to bring that message to you. And what's very interesting in all of this, that same principle applies with what we might call the horizontal commands of one another. Think about that in worship. We go to the book of Colossians, and the Apostle Paul says this, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God." When we think about a facet of our singing that's to teach and encourage and admonish, that's horizontal. We're doing that one for another. Why? So that one for another, we can build that relationship stronger with God. So what's horizontal then takes a very vertical direction, doesn't it? Our worship is for that purpose. Our worship always must be to glorify God. And here's what we must then understand. That God has full right to insist on the manner of worship. He's not left that up to us. He's not said, you just decide however you want to worship me, and as long as you've got a good heart about it, I'm okay with that. That certainly was not the case with Israel. As we've mentioned, verse after verse after verse saying, this is how you do it. This is when you do it. And it's certainly the case with us as well. I think about what the Hebrew writer told us near the end of his book when he says in chapter 12, verses 28 and 29, "Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship." Who makes that decision? It's God. God determines what's acceptable, and thus, that's what I must follow. Well, two areas where I suppose we've seen the greatest changes taking place in the whole event of recent contemporary worship. One of those has been in our singing. And as we look at what these groups have done that have gone contemporary, oftentimes in the bigger churches, it's more like a concert. It is a concert. You've got the strobe lights, you've got the fog machines, you've got the entertainers, you've got the bands, you've got all this going on. And I imagine that this morning we are in agreement that that certainly cannot be the case, that that goes far beyond what God has ever intended. But also one area maybe that has not gotten quite as much focus is in the choice of songs. I've got the word hymn up there, though many in the contemporary circles would reject that term. They would look at this in the songs that are chosen really to the abandonment of what we might call hymns. And I think for most Christians who are seeking to stay true to the New Testament plan, this is an area where we've got to really sit up and pay attention. There's two areas where we have found a lot of these songs coming in. One of them we just kind of call under a general category of camp songs. Now, let me say first of all, I like a number of what we call camp songs. But there's always a danger in there to get kind of a nice little melody that gets going and kind of an upbeat song. And to include words that are not what God would have. The other areas in contemporary Christian worship, songs that were popularized by singers in the 1990s are finding their ways into songbooks now. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a place where we've got to take note. We've got to be careful about watching for those kinds of things. So, when we're going to worship in an acceptable way, it's got to be with appropriate songs. And we can't go to extremes on either side with this. You know, I can't be someone who says, I'm not going to sing any song written after 1800. They're all bad. No. There are people in 2017 that are thoughtful, spiritual, musical, who are writing very good songs, and they may not follow the same old pattern that songs of the past have, but they're godly. That's fine. We can't say, well, we're going to go through and we're going to ban every song that has any kind of symbolic language in it. We're going to just do away with that. Well, if we do that, we're going to have to get rid of the book of Psalms. Because you look at Psalms, and there's a strong vein in Psalms of symbolic language to give an idea, to give a sense of things. So we don't go to that extreme, nor do we go to the other, where many in the name of contemporary worship have gone. And thus, as we think about the songs we sing, here is rule number one. They must be directed to the glory of God. That's what worship is all about. God has got to be in focus, and if God is not in focus, then that song probably has no business being in a hymn book to begin with. But tying right into that also is that it must be based on objective truth. That's not to say symbolism can't be used, but it cannot obscure the truth. And one area where we have seen many modern songs going is to much more about the subjective feelings that we're having. As I was preparing for this lesson, I came across a man. I have no idea of his background other than he considers himself a worship leader in one of the Protestant church movements. But I was so amazed at what he had to say. He had been heavily involved in contemporary worship. And as he was being interviewed, he had this to say. Over the years, when I would occasionally hear a hymn, the language was always strikingly foreign, with Ebenezers and bulwarks, diadems and fetters, which only served to confirm my bias that hymns were simply out of date. They had served their purpose. They had run their course. The problem with my youthful logic only began to dawn on me about 7 years ago. I had come to recognize that these ancient hymns accomplished something that the new songs weren't. Now pay particular attention to this next line. While contemporary worship seemed to take the listener on an exciting and emotional roller coaster, the old hymns engaged the mind with deep and glorious truths that when sincerely pondered caused a regenerated heart to humbly bow before its King. I'm not quoting here somebody that any of us know or that any of us would consider following his pattern of worship in all ways. But look at what he came to understand. And he went on in this article to say that people would make fun of him. And they would say, you know, jokingly, well, what is an Ebenezer? And he would explain it to them. And then they would say, and I'll use their terms, oh, that's cool. They got it. Why? Because the old, out-of-date hymns weren't quite so old and out-of-date after all. Therefore, any song, whenever that song is written, must glorify God, and it must be based on objective truth. And might I add also, it must be easily sung. One of the hymnists who we sing from his hymns many, many times, it's a man by the name of Isaac Watts. Isaac Watts lived back in the 1700s. And I might add to you, he was considered a contemporary radical in his day. Because what he chose to do was to write hymns that did not directly take the words from the book of Psalms. Those of his particular religious sect believed the only things you could sing were the Psalms out of the book of Psalms. He began to write. And so they considered him a rebel and a radical. Yet, his songs have upheld. There's three reasons for that. They glorify God. They're based on objective truth. And they're singable. You don't have to have a degree in music to sing an Isaac Watts song. And that's one of his express purposes as he wrote. That he wanted everyone to be able to sing, because when everyone can't sing, you begin then to go to a group of participants and a group of listeners. And the next step is those who are entertaining and those who are being entertained. And thus, a worship in song must have these three components. Whether that song was written in 1750 or 2017, these things are paramount. Let me quickly add, this movement has also seen a very great change in preaching. Just as singing was brought to concert level, preaching was brought to a motivational level. You got the most exciting and the most dynamic and the most energetic people you could get who had a very good and pleasant message where everyone could leave feeling very good about themselves. And that's what the worship had become. But what do we find in the New Testament standard? Preaching does not seek to entertain. And it does not seek to lessen the rules. What's its purpose? Its purpose is to glorify God. I want to read you a quote here from a website. As this group was talking about what they had to offer, they said, "The drama team performs quality drama that entertains." Everybody get that? The drama team, first of all, performs and entertains. No, that's not what the gospel message is all about. That is not what we find the apostles doing. That preaching doesn't lessen the rules. Good preaching is preaching sometimes that really causes problems within us, because we realize we're not living in connection and standard with the Word of God. But let me say this also, that a preacher is absolutely duty-bound to preach only God and His message. I'm going to tell you a very painful personal realization of that in my own life. For a long time at the school, those of us who teach Bible are expected to take a week in chapel. And that's hard, because when you've got 250 teenagers sitting in front of you and you're trying to find something that's going to be interesting, you know, that can get problematic from time to time. And I remember, it was many years ago now, close to the early days in my teaching career, I gave a talk in chapel, and I thought I had the perfect illustration to get the kids, and it certainly got their attention, and it was entertaining to them and laughing. And of course, once I got them going, I made the point and thought I had done a great job. And a man who I have never told him about this said one of the best things he could have ever said to me at that point while trying to compliment me. He came up and he said, "Mr. Chandler, good job. Your talk was so funny." And I remember the feeling I had at that point of realizing I had failed miserably in what I had tried to do. Because if the only thing that was being remembered was the funny little story I had to say, I had missed the entire opportunity. That was a life-changing moment. Now with that, am I saying that a preacher can't tell a story? Jesus certainly did, didn't he? The parables were one of his primary teaching tools. A preacher can never have something amusing. Well, Jesus did, didn't he? With a man who's trying to get a speck out of someone's eye while he's got a plank in his own eye. But if ever a preacher turns the focus off of Jesus Christ and onto himself, he has failed as a preacher. And if I am that kind of man, I got to change. But let me add this also. Listeners must not only want, but must demand the message of God. You know what's happened in a lot of the contemporary churches of the 90s that boomed? They reached their peak. There's nothing else to do. You had the best entertainment, you had the best speakers, but that's the thing with entertainment, you always gotta leave them wanting more. That's the danger. And so whether I am the man who is up here speaking or I am the one who is following along and learning from a lesson, there must be a demand for the pure, unadulterated message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when we can get all of that right, our worship will be in reverence and it will be in truth. There can be no exception to that. I want to remind you of a statement the apostle made as he was talking to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 14. Paul said, "God is not a God of confusion." Why do I bring that passage up here? God has told us what to do. He's told us how to do it. He's told us the purpose behind what and how, so that we wouldn't be confused about that. And when we start messing with that plan, confusion is going to result. And the peace that is offered by following the God of order will be surrendered. And thus, as we think about contemporary worship, absolutely, should we be contemporary worshipers. But we must never bow to the pressures of society around us to transform the saving message of the gospel into something that's simply going to appeal and entertain. As we conclude, I want to leave you with a passage I noted earlier. Paul said, "For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe." There may be people who can help you better understand the Word, but salvation is always based on Jesus Christ. No exception. This morning, if you understand what Jesus has told you to do, do it. That's the plan. Jesus has said, "I've paid the price. I've reconciled God and man." And when you come trusting in that grace of God, that He's done everything He could possibly do for you, and you believe in that, and you show that belief in the waters of baptism, fully confident that you will be raised up, your sins forgiven, you need to do that this morning. That's contemporary, as it has been for the past 2,000 years. Or perhaps you strayed from that, and you've gone in areas that you shouldn't go. If that's something with which we can pray with you, we'll be glad to do that this morning. Whatever it takes, let's make sure that we're on God's side and doing things in God's ways.